topic number two. In audio letter number 24 for May 1977, 6 months ago, I revealed the beginning of a Soviet program of preparing for geophysical warfare, with huge nuclear bombs planted at strategic locations under the sea to produce artificial earthquakes and tidal waves. In audio letter 25 for August, I also gave the coordinates of 10 new bombs, cobalt bombs, that had been planted in addition to the 7 super bombs lurking around the Philippine Islands. Since that time, dozens of additional undersea bombs have been planted worldwide, and several have been set off. The strength of the quake that is triggered by setting off such a bomb can vary somewhat, depending on the stresses that already exist in the Earth's crust at that location and other factors. But in many cases, the shock strength turns out to be about 6.5 on the Richter scale, strong enough to do major damage if it were on land. As a result, there have been a considerable number of undersea quakes of strength around 6.5 reported lately, yet the news media never comment on how strange it is that so many quakes are happening with virtually the same strength. The most remarkable case of media silence about the similar strength of so many quakes took place on September 4, 1977, 2.5 months ago. On that day, the Soviet Union set off 4 of their undersea bombs in the Pacific, one at the north end of the New Hebrides Trench northeast of Australia, and 3 in the Aleutian Trench thousands of miles to the north. The 3 main quakes that were produced in the Aleutians had Richter scale readings of 6.5, 6.6, and 6.5 respectively. The one in the New Hebrides was slightly stronger, with a reading of 6.8. These facts were reported in the news, but no one ventured a word about the similar strength of all these major quakes. On November 2nd, Leonid Brezhnev mentioned in a speech his hope that all nuclear explosions, including underwater explosions, could be terminated. But the political stalling tactics against SALT II were just getting underway, and 2 days later, the Kremlin set off another undersea bomb in the Aleutians to remind the Carter administration of what they can do. The result was an undersea quake near the island of Adak, and as usual, the reported strength of the shock was 6.5 on the Richter scale. 2 days later, impatient with Carter administration performance in pushing through acceptance of the SALT II proposals to disarm America, the Kremlin raised the stakes. Shortly after midnight Sunday, November 6, 1977, Jimmy Carter's home state of Georgia became the target for another demonstration of what the Kremlin plans for those who stand in their way. A button was pushed, and a small nuclear mine that had been planted just upstream of the Toccoa Falls Dam in northern Georgia was detonated. Torrential rains in the area were just ending, but as usual, the dam showed no sign that anything was wrong. A year earlier, the same dam had experienced such heavy rainfall that water spilled over the top. This had caused the creek in the valley 200 feet below to overflow its banks, but the dam itself had suffered no damage. For 40 years, the Toccoa Dam had served its purpose without incident, and a visual inspection just 3 days earlier had revealed nothing wrong. But when the Soviet mine was set off, the dam collapsed instantly. The blast from the mine momentarily parted the waters of Kelly Barnes Lake, throwing a wave of water downstream with the dam, and momentarily backing up the water upstream of the mine. Then the bulk of the lake rushed out through the huge breach in the dam, hurtled over 200-foot-high Toccoa Falls, and rushed into the valley below. A double wave of water swept through the Bible College campus below, a smaller initial wave followed by the main body of water. A 3-mile-long swath was devastated, and 38 people died, half of them children. The Toccoa Dam disaster came in the wake of deepening worry over the continued Soviet particle beam attacks on our spy satellites. Within hours, Jimmy Carter postponed his planned trip abroad, telling us that the reason was to push Congress toward adoption of his so-called energy bill. 3 days after the Toccoa disaster on November 9, United States Ambassador Malcolm Toon met at his request with Soviet President Brezhnev in the Kremlin for over an hour, delivering an urgent letter from Carter. No details were released about the letter, but Carter was making two basic requests. One, that the Soviet Union cease and desist from destroying American surveillance satellites. And two, that Brezhnev and Carter meet at the earliest possible moment. But Brezhnev gave Carter no encouragement about a meeting until after a SALT-II accord is reached, and he drummed away at the urgency of finalizing the agreement dictated by the Kremlin. In other words, the Soviets do not intend to tolerate stalling by the Carter administration. The same day, November 9, 1977, events were set in motion that are intended to unleash a Middle East war, and in its wake, nuclear war one. I'll tell you more about that in topic number 3. On November 12th, Soviet pressure on the Carter administration was raised a notch higher. In Erie, South Korea, a railroad yard was suddenly laid waste by a tremendous explosion. Scores were killed outright. Over 1,000 people were injured. Nearly 10,000 homes and buildings were destroyed, and over 14,000 people were suddenly homeless. That blast was heard over 10 miles away. Soviet agents had planned for a railroad car full of dynamite to be in the blast area to provide a cover story for public consumption. But South Korean analysts who arrived on the scene knew right away that this was no ordinary dynamite blast. An explosive sitting on the surface, like the carload of dynamite, produces an extremely wide, shallow crater. But in the Erie disaster, not one but two distinct craters were produced, with an area of overlap between them. Furthermore, each crater was extremely deep compared to its width. One of them 49 feet deep, the other 65 feet deep. And although 30 tons of dynamite produces a very violent blast indeed, each crater corresponds to an explosive force perhaps 100 times that powerful. According to high intelligence sources, Soviet agents are known to have buried two clean nuclear mines in the area where the blast occurred. They were placed side by side, about 100 feet apart, to do maximum damage to the network of railroad tracks. Each had a yield of several kilotons, a fraction of the yield of the Hiroshima bomb, and on November 12, 1977, they were detonated simultaneously. It was a disaster for South Korea, and another shocking warning to the Carter administration that the Soviet Union is not to be trifled with. And when Brezhnev speaks of the urgency of finalizing the SALT-II agreement, he means we are on a short fuse and that he will not be patient for very long. The Carter administration is being backed into a corner so rapidly by the Kremlin that an abortive decision was made earlier this month to pull out all the stops for a preemptive war against the Soviet Union. This idea was to let the chips fall where they may, while we do still have some military might left. But as of 2 days ago, November 19th, the Soviet Union has already squelched this plan, and the war now brewing is back on track to be, as Gromyko said to Carter on September 27, 1977, on Soviet terms. The letter from Carter delivered to Brezhnev on November 9 received no immediate reply. Instead, the blast in South Korea signaled that the Kremlin was growing still more impatient for the SALT-II approval process to get off dead center, and more of our satellites have been blasted this month by Soviet Cosmos interceptors wielding particle beams. By November 18, 3 days ago, there still had been no direct answer, and on that day, the Voice of America was used to hurl a thinly veiled threat at Moscow. Every nation uses its national radio as a tool of propaganda and electronic diplomacy, the United States included. Every message that is broadcast by the Voice of America is heavily censored, edited, analyzed, and picked apart to make sure that every word says what the United States government once said. Bearing in mind that our satellite warning systems are now being destroyed by Soviet killer satellites, listen carefully to these words from the Voice of America broadcast of November 18, 1977, and I quote, "The White House has warned that the deployment of these so-called killer satellites could increase the chances of a first strike in space," unquote. End quote. "The obviously destabilizing danger of satellite warfare is that with its observation satellites put out of commission, a nation would lose a major portion of its warning system and might then consider preemptive war," unquote. In diplomatic language, these words amounted to a very clear threat by the United States to attack the Soviet Union if no satisfaction is received concerning our vanishing spy satellites. On the afternoon of that same day, November 18, Soviet Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin delivered a message from Brezhnev to Carter at the White House. The message made it clear that Washington is in no position to dictate anything to the Kremlin now, that the SALT approval process in the United States is becoming ever more, quote, urgent, unquote, and that the Soviet president would regret being forced to take any measures that might run counter to the recent improvement in relations between the two nations. The full impact of Brezhnev's last comment reached the White House at roughly that same time as the Brezhnev message itself. The NATO underwater sonar nets around Iceland had picked up the Soviet Atlantic submarine fleet, which, as happened 6 weeks ago, was heading en masse into the Atlantic at great speed. At the same time, the huge Soviet Pacific submarine fleet was also on its way toward the United States, and the Gulf fleet was already moving into position to threaten us from the south. Even before the Voice of America broadcast, the Kremlin knew that the Carter administration's response to increasing Soviet pressure over SALT could possibly be some kind of bluff and possibly panic as well. So the Soviet Navy had been dispatched in order to ensure that nothing would get out of hand. And when government officials here learned that the Soviet fleet was on its way here again, they promptly wilted. Shades of Kerensky. As of now, they are once again concentrated on doing as they are told by the Soviet Union, and both the Pacific and Atlantic fleets have headed back toward port. But the Soviet Gulf fleet has not left. It is staying on station for the moment, ready for attack at a moment's notice from our soft underbelly to the south. This is Moscow's way of discouraging the Carter administration from attempting any more bluffs or hasty actions that might upset America's programmed march into final disaster. Topic number 3. Audio letter 22, in which I warned about a horrendous new plan to provoke a Middle East war, was recorded on March 27, 1977. Exactly 1 week later, on April 3, 1977, President Anwar Sadat of Egypt arrived in Washington for talks with President Carter, and the first phase of the CIA Middle East plot got underway. Sadat had in the past been asked from time to time by reporters whether face-to-face negotiations directly between the Arabs and Israelis might be useful. He had always rejected this out of hand, and when asked the same question on April 6, responded in the same way. He said that after 29 years of hatred and 4 wars, the Arabs were not yet ready for such a drastic step. But during his visit here, Sadat was subjected to the psychological programming techniques which I revealed over 2 years ago in Audio Letter 5 for October 1975. These techniques can be used to alter a person's brain wave pattern and inject thoughts and tendencies that differ from their normal thinking. As I told you then, a world leader can be programmed to change his policies, and that is what happened to Sadat. During his visit here last April, a single thought was planted in Sadat's mind, namely, to go directly to Israel to negotiate. It was a thought totally foreign to Sadat, but ever since his visit here, it has been in his mind constantly, and he has been unable to shake it. While Sadat was here on April 7, Prime Minister Rabin of Israel resigned. Supposedly, he was ensnared in a financial scandal, but actually, he had learned of the plot to bring on a war, and he wanted no part of it. Rabin's departure from the scene slowed down this plan. While a new prime minister was elected, it was Menachem Begin. He had to form a government and establish himself on the world stage. But now, the fuse had been lit that is intended to make the Middle East explode into war. On November 9, reacting to the stimulus implanted in his mind, Sadat startled everyone by saying he would be willing to go anywhere, even Jerusalem, to seek peace. Only 5 days later, television interviews of Sadat and Begin by Walter Cronkite of CBS and others set the stage for Sadat's trip to Israel. Sadat's decision to go to Israel was so abrupt that it produced a sharp contrast between Sadat's actions and those of his own foreign minister, Fahmy. While Sadat was on television with Walter Cronkite, Fahmy was in Tunisia at a meeting of Arab foreign ministers trying to rally all the Arabs to a united front in peace negotiations with Israel. 3 days later, Sadat announced his acceptance of the invitation he had solicited from Israel, and Fahmy resigned. For Sadat, the earliest possible moment for the trip was hardly soon enough, because he was now under a psychological compulsion to make the trip. Begin invited Sadat to Israel on or after November 21, but Sadat answered that he would arrive on the 19th, which he did. Now, in spite of the best of intentions, Sadat has been used as a tool of the CIA to narrow the focus of Middle East peace negotiations to the outcome of the Sadat-Begin discussions. It is now a much easier matter than before to torpedo peace in the Middle East, and that is what is planned. The Sadat Peace Initiative to Israel is supposed to be, unknown to Sadat himself, the first step toward war. Meanwhile, the framework for a war to accomplish the objectives described 2 years ago in my audio letter number 6 is being established all around us. The American team in the Sinai, put there supposedly to act as a buffer between Israel and Egypt, is still there, having quietly swollen to a force more than 1,000 strong, armed with F-15s and nuclear weapons. Cautious Saudi Arabia has been drawn into making statements recently in support of the Arab cause that will serve as a sufficient excuse for Saudi Arabia to be included in the nuclear strike against Arab OPEC oil wells that is planned when war comes. Meanwhile, we have been seeing the cover stories in the news about possible acquisition by Israel of large amounts of nuclear materials from America in recent years, planting the idea that Israel has, quote, the bomb, unquote. The triggering of the Sadat trip to Israel and the extremely rapid pace of events must be considered in light of the equally sudden visit to Washington by the Shah of Iran on November 14th. This was the same day that Sadat and Begin committed themselves to a face-to-face meeting during interviews on television. On the 16th, the Shah left the United States, and on that day, Tehran radio broadcasts that there is, quote, total United States commitment to come to Iran's aid in the event of an emergency, unquote. Iran is positioned on the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union, and it bristles with advanced American weaponry. 2 days later, the Voice of America broadcast its war threat against Moscow, which I quoted earlier. But the chess players in the Kremlin had already gotten the message, and the Soviet fleet was already at sea by then. As a result, any active threat Russia may be facing from Iran on its southern flank is offset by an active threat on our own southern flank in the form of submarines on station in the Gulf of Mexico. Thus, while the remnants of the United States government are maneuvering to try to salvage some benefit for themselves from the coming war, the Kremlin is matching every move with counteractive measures designed to maintain their commanding military position. And every day that is wasted by not revealing the truth of these events works to the benefit of the Soviet Union, and that the Soviet Union is consolidating its newly dominant position still further. When I recorded audio letter 27 last month, Soviet cosmonauts had established an initial base of operations in Jules Verne crater on the backside of the moon. However, it was expected at that time that after preliminary preparations, they would very shortly be moving both equipment and personnel to the near side, setting up an operational particle beam weapon almost immediately when they did so. On October 30, the day after I recorded my tape, I was informed that an initial move to the front side had taken place to Gibbs Crater, which is on the southeast rim of the near side of the moon. Since that time, Soviet activity on the moon has been steadily increasing. As of now, there are 7 Soviet particle beam weapons dotted around the near side of the moon, and surprisingly, there are 3 separate backup bases on the far side, including the original site at Jules Verne crater. As yet, all of these installations are very thinly manned, and they are far from being self-sufficient at this point. In order to keep functioning, they must periodically receive supplies from Earth. But the particle beam weapons are operational, and if the normal Soviet pattern is followed, we can expect a test of a moon-based particle beam weapon against some Earth target in the very near future. And if this is done, it will probably take place under circumstances where its effects can be explained away as having some other cause. Possibly for the sake of secrecy, a target area within the Soviet Union, far from populated areas, will be chosen for such testing. But it's also possible that, like the first operational test of an orbital particle beam weapon, the first test of a lunar particle beam weapon might be against some target that the Soviet Union wishes to destroy. In any case, here are the lunar navigational coordinates of the 7 particle beam weapons currently on the near side of the moon. Number 1, east of the Sea of Cold at 55 degrees, 54 minutes north, 51 degrees, 0 minutes east. Number 2, west of the Sea of Crises at 16, 33 north, 48, 51 east. Number 3, southeast of the Sea of Fertility at 31, 53 south, 73, 9 east. Number 4, near the South Pole on the southwest side at 72, 26 south, 67, 30 west. Number 5, near Phocylides Crater in the southwest quadrant at 50, 53 south, 57, 49 west. Number 6, southwest of the Ocean of Storms at 9, 26 south, 66, 52 west. And number 7, northeast of the Apollo 14 landing site, near the center of the near side of the moon, at 1, 23 south, 12, 27 west. The backup locations on the far side of the moon are at number 1, Jules Verne crater, roughly 36 degrees south, 147 degrees east. Number 2, southeast of Pasteur Crater at 13, 36 south, 108, 26 east. Number 3, southwest of Compton Crater at 51, 3 north, 95, 0 east. The Soviet intentions toward us when nuclear war 1 finally erupts are becoming all too clear, because as of November 10, 1977, I'm informed that Soviet agents are still at work throughout the United States, mining additional targets for eventual destruction by remote control. One target area to which I believe I should call specific attention is the Kensico Reservoir, just north of White Plains, New York. On September 21, 1977, 2 months ago, I was called by the FBI to ask for any information I could give them about the situation there. They had been tipped off that the Kensico Reservoir might be in danger in some way and wanted to know what I could tell them. I told them what I am telling you now, that there is a Soviet nuclear mine on the upstream side of the dam toward the east end. I also gave the FBI the locations of other Soviet nuclear devices in the area, such as one each in the south end of Pocantico Lake, another in the east end of Tarrytown Reservoir, and one in the Hudson River near the east end of the Tappan Zee Bridge. Whatever the FBI may have intended to do with this information, nothing has been done. The bombs are still there. It may well be that they were simply overtaken by events and their hands tied before they could do anything. Because it was only 6 days later, September 27, 1977, that America lost the Battle of the Harvest Moon, and Andre Gromyko delivered an ultimatum to Jimmy Carter for America to start towing the Soviet line. But whatever the reason, the FBI's concern over the Kensico Reservoir leads me to believe I should call special attention to it. Should the Kensico Reservoir be ruptured, the first victims would be the Holy Name School, situated like the Toccoa Bible College in the shadow of the dam. But beyond that, floodwaters from Kensico Reservoir would rampage through White Plains and on southward perhaps all the way to the North Bronx, New York City. The devastation and loss of life would almost certainly dwarf anything like had ever been seen in America. Yet no one is doing anything about it. A major insurance company learned recently from British intelligence about the situation at Kensico Reservoir and went to the New York City police about it, to no avail. Therefore, apparently all I can do is to warn you. My friends, what I've said in audio letter 24 for May 1977, I repeat again now. Behind the scenes, maneuvering and trickery can lead only to disaster for America. Only total exposure of what is happening has any hope at all of turning the tide against utter catastrophe. I pledge to continue doing what I can toward this end, and I ask you to join with me in this very important effort. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless and protect each and every one of you.